party, the other party is trying to act as though we're sort of back to normal. And that imaginary normalcy is, of course, incredibly seductive. But unless we deal with what happened in the last 4 years, unless we deal with the reason we got Donald Trump in the first place, unless we, unless we reckon with the part of the country that has some really crazy beliefs, and with the divided reality that we inhabit, if we think of ourselves as a we, then I think we're enjoying a very, very short respite from a slide toward autocracy.
And we're going to talk more about your book, which is just out in paperback. It's called Surviving Autocracy. Masha Gessen has been our guest. We're going to bring you a part two at democracynow.org. Masha is speaking to us from Tbilisi, Georgia. Masha is a staff writer at The New Yorker magazine, award-winning Russian-American journalist, and has written a number of books. That does it for our show. Democracy Now! Is produced with Renee Feltz, Mike Burke, Dina Guzder, Maria Tarasena, Carla Wills, Tammy Warren.
You're listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. The time is 7:59 a.m. Next up, we have Wednesday Talk Radio with Paul.
And good morning, everybody. This is Paul Rowland speaking at you once again on a nice Wednesday morning here in Southeast Portland, Oregon, where I am. Wherever you are, could be anywhere, most likely in the Portland general area. Could be down in the Mid-Willamette Valley out in the Columbia River Gorge. Anyway, welcome to all of you. This is a listener call-in show. I'm all by myself this morning doing my solo high wire act, as it were. You can help me out by calling up 503-231-8187. I've got a few subjects I'd like to talk about. Of course, if you were listening to Democracy Now! On these airwaves just now, you heard an hour talking all about the Biden-Putin summit. We could continue talking about that. One thing I can almost guarantee they won't be talking about are the dire global effects of the loss of Arctic sea ice and the extreme danger of the thawing of the frozen methane on the seabed. I guess more likely they'd be talking about the militarization of the Arctic, the opening up of shipping channels. I think Biden by now is probably clued in to some degree, one hopes, to the oversized effect that the Arctic has in driving the global climate system. And, since we share, that's one of the main things that the United States and Russia share, have physically in common, is the Arctic. We I think our territories basically touch there, and obviously our interests, economic interests, should be our survival interests should be directed there. But of course, as we know, the political class, the economic class, though slowly the wheels are turning in those realms towards acknowledging the danger of climate change, it's nowhere near up to the speed of what's actually happening on the ground. I've had some guests over the years, experts on Arctic sea ice, climate change experts who've been talking about predicting the imminent demise of the Arctic sea ice. Will it be this summer? Will it be next summer? Will it be in 5 years? But as we know, that the diminishment of that albedo effect, that is the reflection of the sun's rays back from the white snow and ice, as opposed to the absorption by the dark blue sea or ocean, is one of the huge feedback loops that is kicking in, and will be kicking in more and more, as I said, as the if we lose the Arctic summer sea ice completely. You know, up to this point, it does come back. There has been some Arctic sea ice. It kind of ebbs and flows, but the tendency has been downward in terms of the overall square mileage or kilometerage that's covered by ice on the Arctic Sea. It's been downward, and but it has remained some through the summer. And it, of course, it always has come back towards the winter. In the winter, that could be thrown off dramatically if it actually disappears completely during the summer. So anyway, as I said, it's unlikely that they will be talking about that. I guess it's a good thing that they are talking. Anyway, we could talk about that. I would like to talk about this massive heat wave that is punishing the West right now and is a dire harbinger for a summer that looks to be yet again a very, very dangerous summer in terms of drought, in terms of fire danger. But before we go to all that, I just want to sort of throw out a darkly humorous comment by Roger Waters on Mark Zuckerberg. Ironically, I got it courtesy on Facebook, courtesy of my old friend Jeffrey St. Clair of Counterpunch fame. So the quote is, "How did this little prick who started out as 'she's pretty, we'll give her a 4 out of 5. How do we give him any power? And yet here he is, one of those most powerful idiots in the world.'" Well, there you go. That's capitalism for you. So, yeah, I do announce generally on this show that we are on Facebook, and it's KBOO Wednesday Talk Radio. And if you're shy about calling in, which you can do at 503-231-8187, but you can also go to Facebook. Hey, it's there. Might as well use it. We are all trapped in these strange contradictions of the modern world. Totally dependent still on fossil fuels, yet fossil fuels are heading us towards a very, very dismal looking future at this point, unless something either miraculous or unprecedented happens in terms of the control that the nation state political system and the corporate capitalist economic system, or I guess in the case of China and maybe a handful of other countries, a state capitalist economic system, are ruling the planet, and neither of those is very amenable towards changing dramatically the course of things. So, okay, there's an article on Axios, just came out a couple days ago by Andrew Friedman, called "Dangerous Heat Wave Underway in West Will Shatter Records." Well, I just want to say I mentioned that I had in the past talked a lot more about climate change, having a lot of experts, activists on the issue. And I haven't so much, although I did have a couple of youths on a few weeks ago. They were great to have, who are, you know, leading the climate movement, such as it is, and actually doing some really amazing stuff in the face of everything. But in general, I haven't, and I guess I will just say, for what it's worth, that I'm like everybody else. I find it a very overwhelming issue to deal with. And I feel, I don't know, the responsibility of being a talk show host, however large our audience is, I'm not sure, but, you know, we do have a certain listenership, an important listenership, I would add. But certainly don't have the range of a major media outlet, but you know, we are important in the media landscape. But anyway, I do feel a certain responsibility, so I'm kind of caught knowing that I should be dealing with this, but also just, I don't know, feeling a little bit of the dread that comes up with the subject, because really I'm not sure I really see an exit strategy emerging, I guess, let us just put it that way. I mean, I feel like I have been to some extent part of the really amazing work that's been happening in the Pacific Northwest for the past 10, 20 years. It's really shut down quite a few major key pieces of fossil fuel infrastructure, which has certainly given people around the country and around the world further courage and motivation to carry on, and has done, you know, a certain amount to stop the march of the fossil fuel industry. But overall, as I said, it's in terms of the speed with which it's happening. And I don't know. I'd like to hear other people's thoughts on that too. But so let me read a little bit from this. I think it is a very overwhelming thing to think about, just this inexorable march of increasing temperatures due to the unprecedented outpouring, continued unprecedented outpouring of carbon dioxide and other greenhouse gases into the atmosphere. The carbon dioxide levels have once again reached their highest point. I think they're at, what's it, over 420 at this point. I forget the last time I checked. So a punishing mid-June heat wave is set to scorch much of the Southwest and West this week, with Las Vegas potentially eclipsing its highest temperature on record, which stands at 117 degrees Fahrenheit. Why it matters. The heat will build in a region that is experiencing a record drought, leading to dangerous fire weather conditions, high power demands, and causing water supplies to dwindle further. A perfect storm, as it were. The heat itself could prove deadly. Heat warnings and advisories are in effect from the California coast to Utah, northward to the border with Canada, and south to the U.S.-Mexico border. I assume it doesn't stop there either. As monthly as well as all-time high temperature records could be tied or broken through Saturday. Death Valley, California, which holds the U.S. record for hottest temperature ever recorded, could eclipse 120 degrees for several days and reach 127 degrees Fahrenheit, close to the June temperature record for that location. In addition to the Las Vegas record, statewide high temperature records for Arizona, 128 degrees, set in Lake Havasu City, and Nevada, 125 degrees, set in Laughlin, could be in jeopardy. In Las Vegas, overnight low temperatures are not expected to drop below 85 to 90 degrees, posing a health threat to anyone without working air conditioning. The National Weather Service Forecast Office in Las Vegas is warning of significant threats to life and infrastructure from Monday through Saturday as the heat builds and refuses to relent. National Weather Service forecasters note the last time heat of similar magnitude and duration occurred there was late June to early July 2013. During that event, Southern Nevada saw nearly 30 fatalities and over 350 heat-related injuries, as well as temporary power outages. Heat is America's biggest weather killer each year. In Sacramento, California, high temperatures could reach 110 degrees by Thursday as heat builds across the heart of the Golden State's agricultural belt. Even downtown Los Angeles could see highs eclipse 100 degrees today, as areas are just a few miles inland from the cooling influence of the Pacific Ocean roast under the influence of a sprawling heat dome. With the drought and scorching heat, wildfire danger is elevated in many southwestern states, with large fires already burning in Arizona and California, for example. Of note, they say, the heat will raise power demand at a time of decreased output at hydroelectric plants. And of course, we know why that is. The water behind those Colorado River dams, if anybody's seen those photographs, is way, way, way down, exposing thick encrusted mud along the cliff sides and banks that had built up over the decades since those dams were built. And these feedback loops multiply off of each other, as we know. The heat will raise power demand at a time of decreased output at hydroelectric plants. It will also dry soils further, expanding the area of extreme to exceptional drought, the worst categories. If you've looked at one of those maps that are making the round, the entire West is basically in exceptional drought, and increasing amounts of it is in either extreme or exceptional. Here in Portland, we're still in the lower category, but we are still in drought, and the recent rains haven't helped all that much. Already, Lake Mead, the nation's largest reservoir by volume, has hit its lowest level on record. So I was talking about those photos of that. And this heat wave is likely to evaporate more water. And of course, as we know, we talked last week with Jacqueline Keeler about the impacts on the Klamath Lake and the irrigation to a handful of privileged farmers south of there who benefit from that water through a massive irrigation project. Same thing in the western states. Agriculture that happens in Arizona through the Arizona Water Project, that big canal that goes there from the Colorado River. Anyway, so the cities, of course, are dependent, heavily dependent, Los Angeles and Las Vegas, on that dammed river water. So it's all coming to a head, as it were. Red flag warnings for hazardous fire weather in effect in the Sierra Nevada mountains, which are normally still covered with snow at this time of year. I'm sorry if I'm bumming you out, but that's just the way it is. Looks like we do have already a first caller. I'm going to hold off on reading more, and then I've got an old 2013 article, The Truth About the California Water Crisis, from Counterpunch, that's still incredibly timely. Let's go to Ariana. Go ahead, you're on the air.
Hey, it's actually Oriana with an O.
Okay, sorry.
Oh, no worries. It's all, pretty depressing when you start thinking about it. But something I was thinking about, I was listening to your show this morning and also the show before it. And yeah, just kind of the cultural religious connotations with fire and heat, and the whole you're gonna burn in hell, and it seems like we're kind of creating that for ourselves here on earth. So a couple of things I was just thinking about is that piece of the Arctic being really reflective is not something I've heard engineers talking about. If there's a way to make our landscape more reflective, which is kind of an interesting idea. And the other thing I was thinking about, I volunteer with BARC. I don't know if you're familiar with them. They're a nonprofit in Portland doing a lot of forest advocacy work. Yeah. you know, and something they talk a lot about is the whole model of fire suppression on the West Coast, which has been in existence since, you know, colonization, you know, just doesn't work. And a lot of it comes from fear of fire, that a lot of Europeans, when they were coming across the Midwest, there were big fires, and even the religious connotations with fire caused, you know, the firefighters to do fire suppression versus using fire to manage the landscape, which is what was, you know, being done years before. So, yeah, I've enjoyed volunteering with them, but it's just an interesting idea, kind of our associations with heat and fire and how we're responding to this, and yeah, like how not to get overwhelmed by just how depressing everything is.
Well, it's interesting, you know, as you know, obviously that whole social religious complex, you know, that you're referring to, you know, mainly the Christian terms of the idea of hell, obviously, which has had such a major influence on the on both the colonization itself of the world through the
right.
edicts of the popes, and the idea that you know, the Christian white race had a God-given right to take over and whatever, but and they're the ones with the idea of the punishment of hell and fire. So really, I hadn't thought of that, but and they're the one the most extreme kind of version of that is the you know, the evangelical Christianity, which goes so far into this idea of being sort of the privileged and saved ones, that they, you know, they think that they'll be saved no matter what. In fact, some people almost, I think a lot of unfortunately a lot of those people don't tune in to the reality of what's happening, because they're living in this sort of strange dream ideological world. But anyway, a long way of getting to the point that they think that there'll be a rapture. So I wonder if
right.
Anyway, it's just sort of a sardonic look at maybe they'll be saved from the wildfires. But of course, we know that wildfires that are near inhabited areas, like we saw last summer, don't spare anyone, unfortunately. And I just wanted the one thing I want to push back on, and I know I've interviewed people from BARC on the whole wildfire suppression. I totally agree with that. My thing is not just that the whole urban forest interface is the real problem in terms of you know, impacts on people, but my fear is actually that, and I'm not sure if you know, forest activists have really come to grips with the fact that we really are seeing a different kind of fire now. And my fear is that forests won't be coming back as well as they once did with the intensity of the fires and with climate change. I think that's something that people don't talk about enough.
Yeah. Yeah, well, and one thing BARC is focusing on is, well, two things. One is updating the forest management plan, which is a document from the 80s, 90s, that was a result of the forest wars. And so it was supposed to be in place, you know, to kind of mediate all the different parties who are interested in the forest and protecting old growth. And, you know, this document has been undermined over the years. And on top of that, I mean, so much more research has come out about climate change since the document was written. And so nowhere in the document does it even recognize climate change or the need for carbon capture. And, you know, old growth forests, big trees, capture more carbon than new growth trees, than young trees. So that's one of the things they're trying to do. And the other thing is talking about water storage in the forest. So looking at wetlands and beavers and, yeah, trying to slow that water down, because exactly like you're saying, it's a different world now. I mean, the forests are different. I mean, you know, there are some patches of old growth left, but not much. And it is shown, you know, that old growth definitely, you know, can survive fires much better, mostly because there's more water and the trees are older and bigger. But yeah, that was one piece I hadn't heard about, was, you know, that obviously, and I didn't think about this, but bigger trees actually capture more carbon than smaller trees. Makes sense. but I don't think that's necessarily common knowledge everywhere.
No, I was actually part of those forest wars back in the day, and we were certainly talking about that at the time. And it's we were talking about things that only now do they slowly seem to be seeping into the sort of the bureaucratic machinery. The Forest Service, I'm not quite as familiar with now. I know there had been some small shifts in the culture of the Forest Service, but obviously nothing major. But at the state level, there's finally at least some discussion in the media, some discussion about the, you know, even the idea of, you know, salvage logging, which was a huge, you know, after that Northwest Forest Plan was passed, there was various attempts to circumvent it through, you know, riders, appropriation riders to other bills, and you know, one of them was the salvage rider, which was passed back in the early 90s, anyway, the mid 90s, and it led to a whole other slew of timber sales that didn't have the kind of environmental review. And the same thing is going on now in both national forests, state forests, et cetera, is the, you know, this rush to go and take all the dead trees, which of course are good for the recovery of the forest itself, but also they take a lot of standing living trees, especially along highways. They're doing that with the excuse that they're supposedly going to fall on the road. They're dangerous trees. But I noticed there is a slight shift in the discussion, which, you know, I don't know, should be, I guess, encouraging after all these years. But anyway.
Yeah. Well, and one other thing I wanted to push back against you on, which is maybe encouraging, you know, I have some cousins that are from Texas. They're evangelical, homeschooled, you know, the whole deal, very Christian. But this younger generation that I know, like my cousins, you know, in their 20s, 30s, are actually much more educated and interested in protecting the environment and, you know, thinking of themselves as stewards of the earth. I mean, that's a biblical concept. And there are some, you know, young evangelicals, I would say, that are interested in environmentalism, which to me is very encouraging.
No, that's always the hope that generational sort of conditioning will be broken, just like it seems to in the whole upsurge of Black Lives Matter movement, mm-hmm. whereas you know, young white people seem to be a lot more hip than their elders. That would be really encouraging to see.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, thank you.
Thank you for calling in, Oriana. The Forest Management Plan. So, that's something that is really, really important. People can go to the BARC website. That's BARC. I think it's barkout.org, I believe, if I remember correctly. Anyway, well, thank you for calling, Oriana. Looks like we have another caller. Joe, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hey, good morning, Paul. I wanted to go back to something that you had mentioned in light of the heat wave, the expected demands on the energy grid, and just the whole scenario of runaway extreme climate conditions creating these demands on the system that's creating the conditions for runaway climate change is just in this feedback loop. And it's in a way exactly what's insane about the mainstream attitude by governments, especially. John Kerry was kind of quoted as basically going with this corporate plan to allow the economy to keep growing or pursue that as like the driver of economic change itself in order to create some kind of carbon capture system that would be deployed in the future because it doesn't exist now. And at the same time, increasing the demand that it's going to have to meet. And when we like think of how the climate isn't just affecting us humans in the abstract, it's killing the environment, which is going to have these cascading effects for our actual survival. And we experience food shortages and other things, to say nothing of the wildfires themselves, that these models that are banking on business as usual with a techno parachute somewhere at the end are just insane and accelerating us towards a horrible future.
Yeah, it's you're not helping me deal with my sense of doom and gloom in dealing with this, Joe. I need some encouragement here, but no.
The encouragement is that we are not like we can get rid of large quantities of human activity if we can identify it, publicize it, rally around it as like this is part of this like kind of insane delusion that we're in collectively under, of course, force and political agendas, but that. The problem is not really technical at all. It's political, and that if we can believe in ourselves and if we can look to what encourages our belief in our fellow humans, that it becomes a lot more manageable.
Yeah, I mean, no doubt about it. I guess at one point when I first. Not too long, in the first few years when I started doing my radio on cable again after a 20-plus year absence, I was talking to a guy named Paul, what's his name? Anyway, a PhD student in basically accelerated climate change, kind of on the cutting edge of studying these dynamics. And he actually was advocating for technological solutions, for technological carbon capture schemes, basically a three-stool approach. One is, you know, cut out producing and burning fossil fuels. Two was, carbon sinks, carbon capture. I'm missing the third one. Anyway, so he was actually advocating for technological sucking carbon out. Oh, and the other one is actually geoengineering, some either seeding the oceans to produce plankton or putting reflective substances up in the atmosphere. But basically because he saw that, and that's why I think I've had discussions with you about, what is the timing of things? It's really all important. How fast is it happening? What's actually happening? So his view that we just didn't have the time to make the political and societal changes because it's coming at us so fast. I think that's a question people really don't want to deal with. I had a hard time with it because I'm what people call a Luddite. I'm basically anti big scale technology, which is a big subject. But so I thought I was forced to entertain those questions because, frankly, I saw the speed at which the reaction to the response to climate change was happening was just not anywhere near adequate, and I don't see it as having gotten any better, several years on down the line. So I could agree with you in theory and principle totally in my heart of hearts, but actually I really wonder, and of course these are untried technologies, and the more we don't actually put any actual research and development, I mean, basically here, let me just finish this and then I'll give you the floor. Where I had come to, which is as pie in the sky as anything else, is that, somehow we have to seize the assets of the corporations, especially the ones like BP that are, whenever there's a huge disaster, basically we should just shut down the corporation, seize their assets, and use it for both cleaning up the mess to whatever extent can, and addressing, the root, the actual ongoing, dynamic of climate change. But, of course, that's, the kind of large-scale socialist program that is anathema to huge swaths of the political class and the population. But so we need to seize their assets because those are the largest. We've got the federal government and we've got corporations that have the largest pools of assets. We've got hedge funds. We've got you know, large pools. We've got, you know, pension funds. We've got these big pools of capital. Those have to be deployed immediately towards, sure, planting more forests, removing forests from corporate activity, logging, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, I could go into much more detail. But I also thought they should be deployed into actually researching the best possible technologies for actually, you know, removing carbon from the atmosphere. Because I really think we're at that point, you know, because so Yana, what do you think of all that?
Well, I don't got that much time to comment on all that, but I, for one, like the idea of seizing the assets of corporations that screw up, and we know we did that basically 100 or more years ago with monopolies, and there was kind of like a political argument then about the monopoly like competing for social power and being able to wield that to socially detrimental ends, and that is totally the case with these corporations. Even if they may not be monopolies, they're kind of part of a monopoly energy industry, and they're just operating in ways that are materially harmful. But as far as like the political will thing, there was an article that came out of study, a meta-analysis done by some European environmental science scholars, specifically on degrowth considerations for the way that like the IPCC's climate change projections mesh with possible responses, including like these all-out techno-utopian ones. And the focus of the research was on like kind of this missing consideration of like, what if we're able to scale down the way that our energy systems create these demands? Their findings basically suggest that we have a better chance of actually employing these technologies if we focus on that, if we focus on cutting out what exists rather than try to bring into existence things that don't, which is just a totally different kind of question, that we increase the chances of any technological response to these changes, like stabilizing anything or bringing the worst within the range of the tolerable. And that as far as the political will, that like, they admit that that's a challenge, and they kind of measure that out in ways that they would go in the article, but that it's also one of the most elastic. It's the one that is not bounded by like physical conditions that you can't negotiate with and don't have all the plasticity of human culture and human psychology, and that as how to like kind of, I think, break through the spell that I think is holding back the tremendous amount of human potential that could put an end to these things, or could put enough of an end to the things that we need to, is to break the kind of like hegemonic obsession with growth for one thing, and with the idea that like we need to replace fossil fuels, we need to replace like the whole economy. And it's not as wild of a proposition as we think. If we think of how we share things, how we can repair things, if we think of doing things in a way that doesn't create all this extra busy work, because that's contributive to GDP and is part of this Rube Goldberg machine economy, that there's a lot of potential there. And that's what my advice to like lean into is, that we have to be focusing on each other, because all of these plans are, even though they're coming from people, they're kind of coming from without us, and they're kind of coming from that place of the structure that we feel is over determining everything we can do. And the reality is we can over determine that.
Fair enough. I guess
I gotta go
whenever you want.
Thank you.
What's that? Okay, thanks. Well, so, you know, the Green New Deal, which is sort of the most, I don't know, sort of the largest political formulation of a political response to what's going on focuses on, you know, so-called green or clean energy, which is, I think, I don't know, Joe, I think Joe might agree with me, unless you deal with this lock of growth, profit and growth as being the, you know, sort of the God-given way that things work, or the best way to achieve social goods, or, you know, whatever crazy way of thinking you might have. Unless it deals with that, which, of course, you know, the whole idea of degrowth does get at. I'm not as familiar as Joe is with it. But the Green New Deal needs to, you know, include, and it does, of course, include, it includes all kinds of transitions. Obviously, includes, you know, what people talk about, energy efficiency. It talks about, you know, transitioning the kind of jobs you have from, you know, fossil fuel sector jobs to other jobs, and, you know, green, so-called green energy. Obviously, I'm not against, you know, what is called green or clean energy. Obviously, I think that we still tend to, you know, when it's in the maintaining the corporate sector, it tends to, when it has to make a profit, it tends to just have a distorting influence on it. So we need to somehow take that out of it. So yeah, community-based solutions, small-scale community, you know, small-scale solar, you know, passive solar, you know, electric solar, small scale on the houses. I think this new generation of wind turbines is really interesting. Not the large rotating blades that is sort of dominates the, you know, that people want to put offshore, that people want to put all over the place. At a smaller scale, these rotating ones that are kind of like a shape like a nautilus kind of inside, where they spin horizontally. I said I was kind of Luddite anti-technology, but since we've got this massive technological capacity, why don't we put it towards the best possible solution? So I think, you know, we should, you know, favor, instead of, well, obviously end all fossil fuel subsidies and put them towards, you know, could be put towards, instead of just corporate our research and development, put it to some of these smaller scale ones where maybe some of the best ideas are. So yeah, I think there needs to be a massive redeployment of research and development and capital and research and development. Anyway, I've spoken too much. 503-231-8187. We are already at 8:41, and we've only had two callers, so let's get a couple more callers. I do think that we need to be much more massive discussion of this. You know, I think KBOO itself should be more fully devoted. I know there's so many things going on, and so many things that are distorting our ability to even focus attention. You know, the continued grip of a white supremacist colonial culture on all of us, the continued drumbeat of racist attacks on people of color that rightfully force a response, demand a response. And it's great that there's a response, but, you know, there is this massive planetary threat that is happening that we cannot be further distracted from. So as I'm waiting for someone else to join me on the airwaves at 503-231-8187, I've got this article from 2013 from Counterpunch by Joshua Frank, The Truth About the California Water Crisis. It doesn't take too long once you've left the greater Los Angeles area, away from all the lush lawns, water features, green parkways, and manicured foliage, to see that California is in the midst of a very real, potentially deadly water crisis. Acres and acres of abandoned farms, dry lake beds, empty reservoirs. The water is simply no longer there and likely won't ever be back. What's happening here in California is far more than a severe drought, as the media labels the situation. The word drought gives the impression that this is all short-lived, an inconvenience we have to deal with for a little while. But the lack of water isn't temporary. It's becoming the new norm. California's ecology, as some 39.5 million residents know, is forever changing, and climate change is the culprit. At least that's the prognosis a few well-respected climatologists have been saying for the last few decades. And their predictions have not only been accurate, but they've been conservative in their estimates. UC Santa Cruz professor Lisa Sloan co-authored a 2004 report in which she and her colleague Jacob Sewell predicted the melting of the Arctic ice shelf would cause a decrease in precipitation in California, and hence a severe drought. The Arctic melting, they claimed, would warp the offshore jet stream in the Pacific Ocean. Not only have their models proved correct, Professor Sloan told Joe Rahm of Think Progress she believes, quote, the actual situation in the next few decades could be even more dire than their study suggested. As they anticipated 15 years ago, and this is now 8 years old, this article, the jet stream has shifted drastically, essentially pushing winter storms up north and out of California and the Northwest. As a result, snowpack in the Sierra Nevadas, which feeds water to most of Southern California and the agricultural operators of the Central Valley, has all but disappeared. Winters are drier and springs are no longer wet, which means when the warm summer months roll around, there's no water to be cultivated. And this goes on. This is, again, an article from 2013 in Counterpunch. The truth. Well, actually, this just was just republished today, I believe. And it's a longer version of this article appeared in the August 2013 issue of the Counterpunch newsletter. So, again, looks like we already have two more callers to engage with. Go ahead, Monica. You are on the air.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call, and thank you for your program. I'll be really quick. There's a book that's written by a woman here in Portland, Kristen Olson. The book is called The Soil Will Save Us. And in it, she goes through farming methods. She talks about three key issues. One, compost. Two, cover crops. Three, crop rotation. And then the key is, when you're running livestock on the soil, to never let it stay, never let cows, whatever, in one place more than one day. And you can completely rebuild the soil structure, which then begins to absorb the carbon dioxide. And a really key point was that within 3 years, if we got only 11% of the land that we farm into this type of farming, we could absorb all the carbon dioxide emissions that we are dealing with right now. So I find that very hopeful. And I believe that we could start it on extremely small. I mean, it would be great if we got GoFundMe or all of these funding mechanisms and then started buying up the land and started farming it that way. And it takes 3 years, and we could at least make a start on it. I think we're we can't really turn around exactly what we've done, but we can certainly repair a lot of it. And the other thing I'd like to say is the energy it takes to fight against something is completely different than the energy it takes to build something or to work on something that you love. So it, your despair about the politics, I think, is justified, but maybe we shouldn't fight that. Maybe we should do the thing we want.
But how do we do it if we don't, if, you know, it's all political. Anything in society is political, where people are making some decisions and not making other decisions. So the decisions that are being made are governed by these large-scale political and economic forces. And so how do you redirect the energy is the problem.
Yes, you've got
people who are stopping you from doing it is the problem.
Well, except for, I mean, we can do it in our own backyards. That's one thing we can do right away. If you have any piece of soil at all, you can quit uncovering it. I mean, walk around the city of Portland, you'll see all this bare earth, which is just a horrible thing to do to the soil. So we can do it ourselves on these small scales, but, and I hate to say this, taking advantage of a bad situation, but there's going to be farms and stuff that go out of business because of everything that's happened, we can start buying that land up and restarting it with these concepts, with these basic concepts, and get it going. You know, well, just I mean,
I certainly don't disagree with you. I've done that. I feel like I've done that on my own. I had, you know, bought a house with my mother. I'm taking care of, and there's a gravel parking lot on one side of it, and almost half of it I've now made into a garden, and I compost all my leaves from my trees, and I put that back into the soil. So yeah, I mean, I've been doing that for, you know, decades on my own. So I totally obviously agree with you. My issue, I guess, is that when you say we can, you know, in 3 years turn this thing around, that I think, if I haven't read the book, but that seems to imply a kind of larger scale. So the kind of increment, how many years would it take for the kind of incremental change? And my point that I had with Joe is, how much time do we realistically have?
Really,
that's the
not
question
much.
That we continue to avoid. It's like, is it already actually too late? Do we have, you know, people say, I remember, you know, 20 years ago, people said, oh, we have, you know, 15 years. You know, maybe 10 years ago, people say, oh, we have 10, you know. It's like we keep throwing around these things, but do we actually have a realistic idea? This is because it's a really important question. How much time do we actually have?
Yes,
so
it's very
scary. It changes our response.
Yes, it's very scary. Now, I'll let you go on to your next callers, but I just want to say, it's only 11% of the farmed land that we need to capture and turn around, you know. So, look at Greta Thunberg, the following she has. Get her followers to give everybody a dollar and buy up 1,000 acres. So, anyway, keep on keeping on, Paul. I know it's terrible. It's very scary. It's very depressing. But there is hope if we can grab a hold of these threads. And thanks for taking my call.
All right. Thanks, Monica. No, I certainly, that is a piece of the picture. And, you know, as Oriana said, the, you know, stopping cutting any more old growth or ancient forests, which are the biggest absorbers of carbon, stop cutting all native forest that is transitioning into being old growth forest that is, you know, absorbing more carbon. Put more forests into absolute protection. Bring back the beavers to create more water on the landscape. Slow down the runoff of the water, because, you know, as we lose our glaciers, then we're speeding up the water from the high areas to the low areas. And so, yeah, just, you know, we could, you know, there's probably going to be the need for large scale, I hate to say it, engineering of, you know, mountain landscapes to stop the fast runoff. You know, why don't we use all these bulldozer and heavy equipment instead of continuing to add to the constructed built landscape, which is removing, which is having a bad effect by removing soil, removing the vegetation from soil, et cetera. Why not put it to the, you know, the emergency use? You know, anyway, so those are all interesting ideas. We've got two more callers in very little time, so let's go to Arthur. Go ahead, you're on the air.
Well, thank you, Paul, and good morning. All your callers have made such excellent points. I would say that depending on our national political leaders to solve the climate thing, it's probably not going to be effective, because they're selling all kinds of heavy weaponry to Saudi Arabia. That's a whole other issue, but they seem to have no morals, so I'm not sure they give a damn about their grandchildren. But we can do things as individuals. The last caller was very interesting. She essentially said to to try to make a difference on your own. And so I live, okay, let me give you a little quick background and then I'll shut up. I was homeless for 2 years, sleeping in a tent. Now I'm luckier. I've got a degree in mathematics. Used to teach college and high school. And I used to have all kinds of labor experience, including groundskeeping. Here's what people can do to stop the doom and gloom, Paul, as quick as possible. I think first, if you have anywhere you can plant a tree and you have a shovel, you should go out and plant a tree. The bigger, the better. If you can plant a fruit-bearing tree, that would be good too, like something people can eat in the future. Paul, can I ask you a question?
Sure.
Did you drive your car to work today?
I actually don't have I live at home and take care of my elderly mother. That's my job, so I don't have to anywhere.
That's a big job, and congratulations. Are you inside your own apartment then, doing a broadcast or whatever?
A house, but I think we have very little time left, Arthur. So
okay, I'm gonna say it real quick here. One, you got to retrain workers. You got to retrain workers from making cars and spraying bug spray, and retrain them to install solar panels on rooftops. You got to take the creeks in Oregon, Portland, that used to have salmon runs, and pay homeless people $20 an hour to get that trash out of there.
And those are all political things. So if you're saying we can't trust the political class,
when you say political, though, there's national politics and there's local politics. Those are two different politics. That's local politics I'm talking about. So that's my point.
Yeah, okay. So I totally agree. I think those are great ideas.
I talked to a guy from Ethiopia, a big family, and they're so proud of the new dam they're building to provide electricity for everybody in the country, because the Nile River starts in Ethiopia. And I just gently mentioned that maybe they should just have solar panels on each rooftop. Okay? And at that point, I'm going to leave it because we're running out of time, Paul. Thank you.
Well, thank you, Arthur. Appreciate it. Yeah, you know, all these, I've said it and I'll say it again. I don't see any contradiction between engaging in individual solutions like I think I do on my own, and a lot of people obviously who listen to this station, but I don't see a country between that and actually engaging in collective action of various kinds, even all the way up to engaging in electoral politics at whatever level, and advocating for a Green New Deal and demanding our political leaders actually, you know, change the tax code on corporations and such, which will free up resources. I don't know if we can squeeze Alan in real quick. We've got about 2 minutes. Go ahead, Alan. Are you still there? Well, Alan's gone.
Sounds like we lost him.
Oh, we lost Alan. Sorry, Alan. I was talking too much. Well, we've had some really good callers. And there's a bunch of other stuff we could have talked about. Continue to talk about the Klamath Basin, which of course is part of that serious drought scenario that is increasing the social contradictions, including between the settler colonial establishment and the indigenous peoples that had been marginalized through that process, but still are there and still have their traditional way of life is still better than, at least more sustainable than what European Americans have concocted on this beautiful continent. It used to be a lot more beautiful. Anyway, the People's Rights Campaign that Jacqueline Keeler talked about, an article, The People's Rights Campaign to Overturn Tribal Water and Fishing Rights in the Klamath Basin by Chuck Tanner a few days ago. That's from the website that she talked about, www.irehr.org, and so much more. I could go on, but we're just about out of time, so I'm going to call it right there, talking from a couple articles on Axios, potentially deadly, dangerous heat wave underway in West will shadow records, the truth about the California water crisis, republished today on Counterpunch by Joshua Frank, and more. Thank you, Ty, for operating the board. Thank you, everybody, for listening. Thank you, everybody, for calling, and I'll talk at you next week. Bye-bye.
You're listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath, 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. The time is 8:58 a.m.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with the requirements of the